Welcome to Front and Center, brought to you by Frontier Communications. I'm Dan Lovato, and we are so pleased to be joined in studio once again, and you have heard him on the program before, Frank Galluni. And Frank, of course, is with Asnuntuk Community College, and we've got him back today to talk about his fascinating history. And Frank, once again, welcome to Front and Center.
Thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate your inviting me back.
You're
I thought
welcome.
For sure this would be a one-time deal.
And we'll just ask you to get a little closer. Here we go to our microphone.
Fine.
That's actually my elbow creaking. Anyway, Frank will take your phone calls. 888-574-2723 is our telephone number. And one of the reasons we wanted you back is your involvement in government programs that actually have worked. You have been recognized by the former governor of Massachusetts, Governor Dukakis. You were recognized on the floor of the United States Congress by then U.S. Representative Silvio Conti. You have interacted with presidents of the United States. So I want to rewind a bit, going back to your interest in getting involved with government job programs. How about starting from the beginning?
Yeah, basically, I was a young school teacher in Springfield, Massachusetts, and had heard about a program called the Manpower Development and Training Act of 1962, started by John F. Kennedy. And it was basically for the purpose of taking people who were on welfare, ensconced in welfare, a legacy of welfare, or had some personal issues, had been incarcerated. And the idea was really to take those people and provide them with some basic education followed by some skills development and get them into the workforce and break that whole cycle of poverty, that cycle of welfare dependency. Unfortunately, I disagreed with the tenet of the program, which was that there had to be first an ability to read and write at a certain level before you could participate in a manufacturing or a clerical or any kind of program. And I said, no, this isn't smart. This isn't going to work. And so I bore with it for a while until I became the supervisor of the program. I left teaching, founded a training facility with 80 students, 8 teachers, $300,000 of federal money. And everybody laughed at me and said, this is impossible. We went into a former factory that was like 500,000 square feet. We only needed maybe 8,000 or 9,000 square feet, but it was free. It was rat infested. It was in the north end of Springfield, Massachusetts. And we started out with those 8 teachers, those 80 students, and we grew it to a point at which we served over a period of about 20, 25 years, more than 40,000 youth and adults through a program that changed dramatically from doing things sequentially to doing things contemporaneously. So that what we decided to do, or I decided to do, was rather than give people this tedious process of developing their reading, writing, and arithmetic independently, 6 hours a day, 30 hours a week. Well, you know, realistically, most of these people had dropped out of school because they didn't like school. They didn't like reading, writing, and arithmetic. So here I am saying to them, this is what you're going to do in order to get to that next level of skills development, of actual job placement opportunities. You need to do this first. Well, that I changed that. And I said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to set up a pyramid. And we're going to develop a program whereby we're going to start you out with 4 hours of basic education and 2 hours of skills training, whether it was in clerical, electronics, machining, welding, whatever it might have been that they had an interest. And we said, okay, you're going to start 4 and 2. Then if you do well academically, it'll be 3 and 3. Then eventually we'll change it to 2, 4. And ultimately, it may very well be that within 3 or 4 months, you will have 6 full hours a day of advanced manufacturing training or some kind of developmental process that's going to lead you to long-term career employment. And that seemed to have worked very, very well. And we went through MDTA in the 60s, and then President Nixon came in with this awful thing called CETA. It wasn't his fault, but somehow it really focused more on putting people to work rather than training people. And the work that people went to was mostly in the public sector. They worked in libraries and in city halls and in school departments. And it was really from the standpoint that at that point, unemployment might have been 12, 13, 14%, and they just wanted to get people back into the workforce. Well, there were all kinds of issues with that. You know, people weren't showing up for work and getting paid. People had died and were still getting paid. There were all kinds of situations. So as a result of that, nationally, this program was looked at as one of ineptness, collusion, corruption. And somehow, some way, a reporter for the Washington Post heard about this place called the Mass Career Development Institute in Springfield, Massachusetts, that seemed to have been able to avoid and avert all of those issues and was really training and educating people, welfare recipients, unemployed, underemployed people, formerly incarcerated people, young people who had not graduated from high school, and was somehow getting them into an employment career. And that reporter called and said, I want to come up to Springfield and spend 3 or 4 days because I don't believe this. I said, well, fine, you're more than welcome to do that.
A reporter from the Washington Post.
Yeah, Warren Brown from the Washington Post came up and spent 3 or 4 days in Springfield and talked with, you know, literally scores and scores of our students, talked with employers, talked with me and a number of others with whom we were involved, and wrote this wonderful 4, 5, 6 column article in the Washington Post Memorial Day, actually, in 1978, about this unbelievable place called the Mass Career Development Institute, this anomaly, this unusual place in which people actually were getting something out of a program and being able to go to work.
A phenomenal job placement rate, which you wrote about in the story.
Yeah, well, I mean, we did some marvelous things with people who really didn't have a lot of self-confidence. And as I've said to you before, the concept really that we evolved was one of duping people, and in the most favorable, in the most benign, in the most magnificent way. And in essence, people came in because they knew they were going to be involved in machining or in some clerical or health careers program. And we gave them every opportunity to be involved in those programs, knowing that through tangible results development that we could then impact them from the standpoint of their self-confidence and self-esteem, from the standpoint of their basic education skills. Once we got their attention and once they realized that they could develop a real set of tangible skills, then we knew that we could provide all of the counseling and all of the basic education services so that when they left us, they did not only have a set of work skills, but they had a set of attitudes. They had a set of impressions of themselves as totally different from when they came into the program. They knew that they could survive, sustain, grow, and develop in the private sector. And in essence, you know, we're still doing those kinds of things today.
What did you see or what did you do back in the 60s when you started the Institute to actually interest people who had no interest in basic education? What did you do to captivate their attention?
And what we did basically is we went out into the community, we went out into the welfare facilities, we went out and met with people, we had evening programs, day programs, summer programs, and in essence what we demonstrated to them or showed them is this is what you could get by being in this machine shop, by being in this fabrication facility, by being in this electronics area. So their interest was piqued by the fact that they could do these hands-on kinds of things. And we were able to capture their attention because we provided them with those opportunities, but at the same time also recognized that the far more important ingredients were the reading, the writing, the arithmetic, and the self-esteem, self-confidence, self-respect, etc. So we used the crucial of, you know, giving them hands-on skills and then, and it's like anything else, Dan, it's word of mouth. I mean, when you're in a community of people who are living close to each other in neighborhoods where there is a lot of at-risk population, word spreads immediately. You got a job. How did you get this job? Where did you go to get the training and so forth and so on? Well, I went to the Mass Career Development Institute. So that spread in the North End, the South End, Holyoke, Chicopee, and all over the community at some point in time, to a point at which we were, you know, involved with more than 1,000 students a year in those programs. And we never had problems finding people to come into the program because they realized that, if they committed themselves for a period of 6 months to a year, there was an opportunity for them to transition for the long term. And, you know, that's the big difference. Not a job, a career. To leave and know that they would be able to be in the workforce for the next 15, 20, 30, 40 years. That was the key, but it's really word of mouth. I mean, it's just like as Nuntuck. It's word of mouth. I mean, people from Springfield or Hartford or all over Connecticut realize that what we do there is allow and enable and empower people to transition effectively and long term to great careers that pay $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year. So, like anything else, your best advertising is your end product.
Now, you had government assistance, or did you not?
Absolutely, yeah. The Mass Career Development Institute had significant levels of federal assistance. There was very, very minimal state or local assistance at that juncture. Most of the money was made available through those aegises we talked about, which is whether it was MDTA, whether it was CETA, whether it was then JTPA under Jimmy Carter. And so we always had federal assistance to provide the facilities, the equipment, the faculty. Yeah, it was absolutely.
Among the ultimate compliments the Institute has was the fact businesses were not reluctant to go to the Institute and hire graduates. Talk about that.
Yeah, basically that was one of the major hurdles that we had to overcome, because there was always an attitude among employers that if you're an at-risk person, if you had been incarcerated, if you had drug abuse issues, if you had not graduated from high school, well, how could you really be expected to have the skill sets that we need? And we weren't looking at labor-intensive positions. We weren't looking at construction. We weren't looking at, you know, health aides. We weren't looking at low-level positions. We wanted people to get into welding positions and machining positions and electronics areas and higher-level clerical positions, so that they really did start a career. They could go on and continue their education. So it was a very, very difficult process at the outset of communicating with employers. And what we did, like, you know, most other programs, we had an advisory committee of 8 or 10 employers who felt comfortable that this was the right thing to do. And then realized, well, not only was it the right thing to do, it was a smart thing to do, because they were getting people from these resources that were working very, very well for them and giving them more profitability, certainly. So, again, it's an issue of finding those 5 or 6 or 7 adventurous souls, those Daniel Boone, Lewis and Clark types who are willing to, you know, to blaze the trail, so to speak, and you grow that, you develop that. And, you know, 10 begets 20 and 20 begets 40. And all of a sudden, you have 100, 150 employers who are involved, just as we have in Connecticut. I mean, there are literally scores and scores and scores of employers with whom we work on a daily basis.
So then we fast forward to President Carter, and he comes up with a program to replace CETA. Talk about that.
Yeah, the Job Training Partnership Act, JTPA, came about in 1978, I believe. And in fact, you know, President Carter took the time on a Saturday night to call my home. And wanted to talk with me about what we were doing and how we were doing it, because he had heard from people like Silvio Conti and Ted Kennedy and others about the wonderful work that we were doing at the Mass Career Development Institute. So one Saturday night, the phone rang at my home, and my 11-year-old daughter, Maria, picked up the phone, and the woman at the other end said, "This is the White House, and President Carter would like to speak with your father." And my daughter commented that this was Auntie Ursula, and stop fooling around here, because this is a terrible joke that you're playing, Auntie Ursula. And so finally, after a minute or two, I said, "Maria, you better let me see who really is on the line." And indeed, it was the secretary at the White House, who had President Carter right next to her and wanted to talk. So he and I talked for a bit. He was kind enough to allow my daughter and my one son at that time, Frankie, to talk with him. And then his wife got on the phone and talked with my wife about, you know, you having children after many, many years and so forth and so on. So it was a wonderful, wonderful discourse. But really the purpose was to talk about my work and how we can spread that kind of gospel, you know, in other parts of the country. And we did a lot of traveling over a period of time in the 70s and 80s and exploring with others in Massachusetts and Connecticut and all throughout New England and the Northeast, that these kinds of things were the right things to do. It took time, it took energy, it took passion, it took commitment. But indeed, when you saw, you know, 700 or 800 people annually leaving your program and going into a positive work environment, it was well worthwhile. So, yeah, so Jimmy Carter was very, very important to the process of changing that whole concept of CETA, which was just put people to work. Right. And, you know, knowing that those jobs were in the public sector, so they weren't going to last more than 6 months to a year, and recognized that we needed to give people long-term opportunities. And we needed to give employers, people who have the ability to do the kinds of work that was necessary.
So when you traveled the country, did they implement your suggestions at some of these other places?
In many, many areas, in the Midwest in particular, and in the Northeast, yeah, there were a lot of great programs came about. Rhode Island in particular, I can recall, started to establish programs analogous to that, which we were doing. A lot of other Massachusetts cities and towns in the Midwest, whether it was Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, a lot of areas where the Rust Belt and who had similar issues that we had in Massachusetts with, you know, what was happening with manufacturing. Was it going to stay? Was it going to go? What was going to happen? So there were a lot of commonalities among some of the states that I visited.
Manufacturing itself led to an interesting discussion that you had with Governor Dukakis. Relate that to our audience.
Yeah, I hope the governor isn't listening. But when Governor Dukakis was running for the presidency of the United States against Bush Sr., he would come to Springfield once in a while, and he and I would take a ride, and we would talk. And the governor was insistent that, Frank, you know, you're all wet about manufacturing. Manufacturing died. Manufacturing is gone. You know, it's low level, and we should let it go to North and South Carolina and to China and Mexico. Because, you know, our future is IT, information technology, you know, the computer age and so on. So I said, Governor, New England, whether it's Connecticut, Massachusetts, the bedrock, the Eli Whitneys and all of these people, this is manufacturing. We are manufacturers. That's what we've done. That's what MIT's about, WPI's about. We need to stay afloat with manufacturing because it's going to have a revival. No, Frank, it's not going to happen. Well, unbelievably, Governor Dukakis is now a visiting professor at Northeastern University. And he calls Frank Galluni every once in a while and says, Frank, you know, don't say anything because I'm going to apologize again and again and again profusely. You were right. I was wrong. And I always tell my Northeastern University students, if you want to find someone who can give you a history of what's happened over the last 30 years in advanced manufacturing and this renaissance that's taking place, you need to talk with Frank Galluni. And in fact, he's invited me on a number of occasions to come down and talk with students, but I have talked with a number of doctoral candidates about advanced manufacturing as from Michael Dukakis's classes. So yeah, it's amazing, you know, the transformation that's taken place. And certainly it has proven without question that it's been fortuitous that we have stuck and stayed with manufacturing because it is in a real, real growth modality.
Well, this is what we need to hear because there is conversation at times that manufacturing has left the country. Manufacturing is not what it used to be. So what is the state of manufacturing?
I don't think there's any question. Manufacturing is not what it used to be. Manufacturing is now not terribly different from any other high-tech industry. It requires higher-level math. It requires wonderful reading skills at 11th, 12th, 13th grade, whatever it might be. It requires attention to detail. Manufacturing has become highly competitive worldwide, whether you're in Japan, Germany, Sweden, Belgium, or in any other state in the United States. It's truly high tech. I mean, if you look at what's happening in this area of additive manufacturing alone, when you look at who's involved, MIT, WPI, RPI, some of the finest institutions in the world, Cal Poly, everyone is involved in additive manufacturing. They see this as the whole new system of building aircraft engines, of ships, and so forth and so on. So there is no question that manufacturing is not what it used to be. It is no longer laborious. It is no longer something that's repetitive and redundant. It is exciting. It's adventurous. It's growth. It's development. It requires continuous improvement, more and more education. There is no question that it is absolutely a marvelous opportunity for many, many young people and adults to look at as a career for the next 20, 30, 40 years. And it's very difficult to sell that because, you know, the one thing that most adults look at, whether you're in education or whether you're a parent, you look at Pratt & Whitney. And, you know, Pratt & Whitney once employed 100,000 people.
Right.
Pratt that. Whitney today employs 10,000 people. But guess what? There are now more than those other 90,000 people are working in Connecticut in these aerospace companies, in these smaller companies that employ 100, 200, 500 people. There are 105 that belong to this consortium called the Aerospace Components Manufacturers. They employ 7,000 people among those 105 companies.
Here in Connecticut?
In Connecticut. And they do more than $2 billion in production. And, you know, the other thing that most people don't realize is that a job in manufacturing, one job in manufacturing creates 2.5 to 3 other positions in the state of Connecticut. So when you look at 7,000 people, you're really looking at another 21,000 people who have somehow become employed as a result of what's happening in manufacturing. So there's a lot of collateral impact that occurs as a result of this. But without question, we are trying desperately to sell and sell and sell manufacturing. And guess what? We're succeeding. You know, our enrollment last year at this time was about 150 students. I think when all is said and done, on or about September 14, we'll be at about 240.
Wow.
We've increased our population by almost 100 students in 1 year. Now, keep in mind, Dan, as I said at our last session, we are building a new 27,000-square-foot facility. We have 23,000 square feet presently. So, you know, by next April or May, we will be sitting on 50,000 square feet of advanced manufacturing technology space. We'll be sitting on about $6.5 million worth of beautiful equipment that is all contemporaneous. We'll be sitting on software that has major implications for what's happening in industry, whether it's SolidWorks, whether it's Mastercam, whether it's Siemens technology. So we're going to 450 people next year.
Wow.
So we're going from 150 last year to 450 next year. So we're succeeding in getting the message out to the degree that I'd like. No. But we are improving. We're getting more and more educators to recognize that advanced manufacturing requires higher education. We're getting more parents to look at it and say, wait a minute now, for $7,000, my son or daughter can graduate with a certificate at Isnunta Community College, go into the employer community in a career starting at $35,000 to $40,000 or more, have an employer ultimately pay for the associate degree and the four-year degree. Are you telling me that for $7,000? And yes, we are telling you that. And it includes textbooks. So
wow.
I think we have a lot to sell, and that's why we love being on shows like this, because it gives us an opportunity for a whole new audience.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about with our guest, Frank Galluni. And welcome back to Front and Center, brought to you by Frontier Communications. I'm Dan Lavallo. Frank Galluni from Isnunta Community College in Enfield joining us, and he's been on the program before. We're talking about not only what he has done heading manufacturing courses at Isnunta, but also throughout his career. This is what he has done. He has started institutes, taught manufacturing. He's been honored on the floor of the United States Congress, recognized by the state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, by Governor Dukakis, has interacted with presidents of the United States. We talked about Jimmy Carter, Frank, but you also had interaction with President Clinton. Talk about that.
Yes. Basically, we visited Washington on a number of occasions during the Clinton administration, and he developed a whole new series of legislation, the Workforce Investment Act, during his administration, and we had ample opportunity to meet with a number of United States senators, President Clinton's White House people, the Department of Secretary of Labor at the time. I used to go down frequently and meet with Marshall, who was the Secretary of Labor, as well as his assistant, and we had many, many conversations, and they used to always talk about the fact that how are we going to be able to replicate this program nationally? And I said, listen, you know, we're available to assist. We will, anyone you want to invite up to Springfield, we'll entertain them for a day, 3, 5, whatever it takes. We'll do as much as we possibly can to influence the process. And so they were always very, very kind and benevolent and very willing to give us money, because they knew that our utilization of their funds would lead to people making effective and long-term transitions to the private sector. So through the Clinton administration, there were always very, very kind and respectful feelings. And as I said, we used to go to Washington frequently and meet with Secretary Marshall and others in the administration, especially at the Department of Labor. So we were frequent visitors to Washington, yes.
Now, there's some notion today that these job training programs do not work, that there's too much red tape, that certain people aren't being taught skills. I mean, what is the state of job training in the United States?
I think a lot has changed. I do believe that over the last 10 or 15 years, with the induction, with the introduction of the workforce investment boards, and the fact that more and more employers are now participating actively in those environments, whether it's in Hartford or Springfield or across Connecticut, they seem to be hiring more professional people to run these operations. At one time, it was political. You know, it was a process in which we had all of these job opportunities, and if you were a friend of the mayor or a friend of the governor, well, then you had a job running one of these programs, because nobody really respected what these what the operations were supposed to be out. I mean, it happened to us in Springfield that we had mayors at times who said, you know, just place all these people, do what you have to do, but I want seven people from my administration to be, you know, employed by you. And we, you know, and I had enough gumption to say, no, I'm not doing that, because I want people who feel as I do, because we're serving people, we're meeting people's needs. So I think a lot of that has changed to a point at which there's a lot more professionalism among these groups, whether you talk with people like Tom Phillips in Hartford or David Cruz in Springfield. These are, you know, consummate professionals who are trying to hire people who are similarly disposed, who really have an interest in inner-city kids or adults who are without employment. I think it's Scott Jackson, who is now the new commissioner of labor, similarly disposed, former mayor of Hamden, Connecticut. So you're seeming to bring about a change in ability, a change in demeanor. So I think there's more of an attempt to make these programs work effectively. So there's no question the CETA days were unique. They were an anomaly. But I think with JTPA, with the WIB, and now WIOA, which President Obama has introduced, there's much more professionalism. I think they're smaller programs. There's more capability, and to some degree, they have been able to help people who are most at risk, many of whom still come to us, Nantuck Community College, through unemployment, underemployment, through these what they call these career centers, where people can go and get services that are available. So we have a nice mix of young people who are just out of school, and then we have those 40, 45, and 50-year-olds who either have been unemployed for a long period of time or have been recently disengaged from the labor force. So I think to some degree there's been a vast improvement in the process of developing people's needs. And more community colleges are getting involved. President Obama has talked endlessly about participation by community colleges. And for some period of time, there was some reticence to get involved in job training programs, feeling that, well, this really isn't higher education. But I've always felt that community colleges were founded for a purpose, and the purpose was that word community, that whatever your community needed, you needed to respond to that need, and the need is in manufacturing significant. So whereas a few years ago, we were the only college that was involved in advanced manufacturing, now there are seven of us. There are only 12 community colleges in the state of Connecticut. I think next year Capital Community College will be joining us in a marvelous endeavor in the city of Hartford, in which we're going to start with fourth grade kids, and we're going to try and do something totally different, totally unique, that really is the epitome of what this STEM thing is about. You know, science, technology, engineering, and math, and now they've added arts to it, so it's called STEAM. But we think that the one most pragmatic way to do this is to start kids 3 hours a week, 36 weeks a year, 108 hours a year, doing project-based learning with kids starting in fourth grade, getting them up through 10th, seven years, 700 or 800 hours of participation, giving them the opportunity in 10th grade to make a decision in their junior and senior years whether they want to get into an advanced manufacturing curriculum in high school, which would involve, as Nantuck and Capital Community Colleges, they could actually earn 30 college credits in their junior and senior years, some most in manufacturing, some academically, so that in 1 year after high school, they can actually earn not a certificate in advanced manufacturing, but an associate degree. Wow. So we're really trying desperately to find ways to fuel this economy, because we know manufacturing is going to grow. And it's going to grow here, or it's going to grow elsewhere.
Because it seems as if the foundation was not poured in the past, because you see this void where certain segment of population is unemployed, and you've got factories that are just craving for people to go to work for them.
Yeah, and I think there was this chasm that occurred, Dan, over a period of 20 or 30 years in which people didn't realize that manufacturing was getting more and more sophisticated. I think that people missed the boat. The feeling was that manufacturing is redundant. You know, you just get in there, and what you learn on day one, you're doing year 20, because nothing changes. Well, that is no longer the situation. The Japanese have taught us that, and the Germans have taught us that, and we have caught on here in the United States, and we have surpassed them. I mean, we are now, without question, the leaders in the world in advanced manufacturing. We may not have produced the equipment, but we know what to do with the equipment. So, I mean, through the MITs and Cal Polys and all of these other great, UConn included, there's a lot of research that's going on that is giving us more and more and more of an edge. And as we begin to implement these edges, it requires higher and higher and higher levels of technology. So we need to evolve and recognize that, no, a high school diploma is no longer sufficient for you to go into a career in advanced manufacturing, whether it's welding, whether it's fabrication, because now you're using lasers, you're using these water jets, you're using these plasma capabilities, so you need math, you need more higher level engineering, drawing skills. So the recognition now finally has immersed community colleges in realizing they have a responsibility to educate other than liberal arts or business or marketing. And so there has been a change in attitude over a period of time that has really been forced upon us by government, by these WIBs, these workforce investment boards, and others will say, listen, who's going to do these kinds of things? It can't be just programs that you start in a Voc Tech high school after, you know, in the evening. We have to have people who can go during the day. We have to have people involved with sophisticated equipment. We have to have people who are learning at higher levels that require professors and others of that ilk. So I think there's been a tremendous change in attitude among educators, especially in higher education. I mean, you talk with Mark Ojakian, the Board of Regents president, who came out of the governor's office and has really adapted well. And you know, he is pushing and advocating on a regular basis for more and more advanced manufacturing programs. And that's the reason why we're getting a 27,000-square-foot facility. Quinnebaug is opening a 10,000-square-foot facility. Hopefully next year we're going to be building a new facility at Middlesex Community College. So we are moving and trending in a direction that says that this is a serious industry. We want to grow it once again. We want to go from 160,000 to 200,000 jobs or careers by the year 2020, 2021.
Now, you mentioned that Governor Malloy understands this void and has moved to try and address it.
He has been, without question, the most significant advocate, the most significant instrument in what is happening in the state of Connecticut. I mean, there is no question that without his interface, without his involvement, without his participation, we would not be at seven colleges participating, would still be as Nuntuck Community College. I mean, 6 or 7 years ago, the governor, you know, admittedly didn't know much about what was happening in manufacturing. Unemployment was streaming at 8 or 9%, and he happened to come to his Nuntuck Community College to tour the facility. I think I mentioned this on the last broadcast. And during that time that he spent with us, there were members of Pratt & Whitney and aerospace components manufacturers who talked very, very candidly about the fact that they had to do something, and it may be moving out of state. And the governor became very, very perturbed and you know, asked a series of questions and wanted some answers as to not only why, but what can we do? And I think I mentioned it in our last session that within a month of that meeting, he placed before the legislature $500 million of incentives for manufacturing to grow in the state of Connecticut. And among those incentives was a $20 million opportunity to replicate what we were doing at Nuntuck at three other community colleges. And those are Naugatuck, Quinnebaug, and Housatonic. That gave us four, and then three others have joined since that time. And without question, the governor has been an absolute advocate of advanced manufacturing, and he sees what we all see who are immersed in this. There's growth opportunity. You know, there probably isn't an industry within our speaking voice that doesn't have a need for 1 or 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 people. I would say without question, we receive 10 to 15 phone calls a week from employers, and it's never one person. It's we need 3, we need 5, we need 10. We get visits. We're touring constantly. We feel as though we're tour professionals. Our teachers come into the office and say, you know, how do I have to dress today? I mean, what's my comportment today? Am I going to be touring? And it's an everyday occurrence. And as a result of that, you know, and not only are we touring from the standpoint that we're getting people excited about what we're doing from the standpoint of job opportunities, but we're doing a lot of incumbent worker training as a result of it. We are working with more than 500 Pratt & Whitney employees annually, upgrading their skills, whether it's in CNC machining, whether it's electromechanical, whether it's tool and die, quality assurance. So there's a tremendous need among people who are in the workforce for additional skill sets. So there's a recognition that that incumbent worker, as well as these new people, need these skill sets. So there's a lot of attention being paid to manufacturing, and Governor Malloy deserves a lot of credit for that.
And, of course, you need to stay updated on all of this because technology is changing by the nanosecond.
Absolutely. You know, and I think the thing I'm really most proud of is that we are very, very conscious of our responsibility to each and every individual who comes into our program from the standpoint that whether it's SolidWorks, whether it's MasterCam, whatever set of software skills that they require, we make certain it's 2016, 2017. We are not reneging on those responsibilities to make certain that the software, you know, you remember the stories about, you know, Windows, you know, it's 2010, you're using Windows 2001. You're saying, wait a minute, you know, the technology is 9 years behind here. I'm going to go out to a job and they're using 2010. You're giving me 2001.
Right.
That was the status quo. You know, in our situation, we will not allow that. So we are investing constantly. And as part of the new 27,000 square foot structure that we're building, we have also been given $3.1 million to purchase equipment for that new building. So we are taking full advantage of that and buying more CNC equipment. We're buying more of the additive manufacturing to a point in which we're actually investing in a metal melting operation with the new building, because we see that's where the technology is going, whether it's Boeing, GE, Pratt & Whitney. There is no question that additive manufacturing, what is simply called 3D printing, is here. It's not on the horizon any longer. It's here, and we need to invest dollars in educating young people and adults for those opportunities.
Yeah, talk about, because it seems to be, particularly among the young people, very fascinating, 3D printing. Mm. What is it?
Well, let me put it as simply as I possibly can. There are two kinds of manufacturing. There is subtractive manufacturing, which has been rampant for the last 50, 100 years. And subtractive manufacturing means basically you give me a piece of metal. I take that piece of metal, I put it into a machine, I ream it, I turn it, I mill it, I drill it, and you know what? That piece of metal becomes, from 1 pound, becomes 2 ounces, 14 ounces around the floor and everywhere else. That's subtractive manufacturing. Additive is unbelievable. You start with nothing, and you build layers. And originally, those layers were made of plastic. Believe it or not, in the last 7 or 8 years, they have now found a way to melt titanium and nickel and some of these precious metals. And now we are using, for 3D printing, we're now building layers and layers of metal. So obviously, the consequences are that you're going to start building aircraft engines. You're going to start building all kinds of nozzles and things of that nature for Electric Boat and for Pratt & Whitney. So basically, the two kinds of manufacturing, and it is most common today, is subtractive. That's the CNC machine. A CNC machine is a computerized numerical control machine. It's like a manual lathe or a manual milling machine that we all remember as kids. And, you know, you could make a part in a day or 5 or 10. With a CNC machine, you can make that part in 10 or 15 minutes because it's computerized. So you go onto a computer and you do all of the processes. You're going to mill it. You're going to turn it. So it has 15 or 16 tools attached to the CNC machine, and they come down and attack that piece of metal. But again, it's subtractive. You're starting with a piece of metal, and you've got all these chips flying all over the place. But it's being done by computer, so it's being done at a much higher speed and much more technology. But now we go to additive and we say, okay, now we're going to the next level. With CNC, because it is a machine and because it has all of these tool sets, you are restricted in what you can do in that machine. So if you wanted to make 10 fingers, for instance, you can't do that in one process with a CNC machine. With additive, you can do anything that your mind will design. So you take SolidWorks or you take some kind of software, you produce something on a screen, on a computer, and believe it or not, you then attach it to the 3D printer, and it produces it. Now, it may take a little bit of time, but nevertheless, it has that capability. So as you grow this industry, and the machines go from these little boxes to these room-sized processes, you're then going to be able to produce aircraft engines. You're going to be able to produce things that you never, never could produce with a CNC machine. Right now, to make an aircraft engine, I think it's 30,000 parts. Believe it or not, they assemble 30,000 parts for an aircraft engine, okay? Right. Now, with 3D printing, you're probably going to be able to reduce that to 3,000 parts or 300 parts because now, instead of these little gadgets, you're going to be able to combine these into one piece and, you know, start to filter it through the process that way. Boeing and GE are predicting that by the year 2020, 75% of the entire aircraft, you know, seats, engine, everything in the aircraft will be produced with 3D printing.
But what's the cost efficiency in all of this?
It's significant from the standpoint, well, number one,
you're not wasting material.
You're not wasting any materials. And also from an environmental standpoint, you'd have all this oil, all these chips, et cetera, et cetera. So if you look at it environmentally, I mean, the conditions are ripe for these kinds of things because we're living in a world in which environment becomes very, very important and the air we breathe, et cetera, et cetera. But, the materials are expensive, obviously. But again, there is no waste. So as a result, what you're producing with a little bit of deburring, a little bit of polishing, you then have a part. So from a standpoint of time efficiency, of actual manual involvement with that part, significant difference from what you can do with a CNC machine. But there is no question that is going to be the future of manufacturing. I mean, CNC is not going to die, but additive manufacturing is going to become more and more and more popular, and especially with the metal melting capability. UConn is investing significant numbers of dollars in the technology, MIT, all over the country. The president has given out hundreds of millions of dollars to major institutions to become more and more and more profound with 3D printing because we see it as really the future of what's going to happen in advanced manufacturing, and it's going to give the United States even greater capability.
Well, that's the other side of the coin, though. You don't show up at the manufacturing facility. You get hired, and then, okay, we're going to train you in this.
Yeah.
You've got to show up already having
Yeah, there's no more the line, you know, outside the door in which, you know, 50 people line up, and we're going to hire 37 of you. We don't know why. You look different from that person, and therefore we're going to hire you. I mean, that's the old style of manufacturing. Today, it is a totally different world. You have to come in with a set of skills. And what we try and do in our program is we try and get people to a point of 75% efficiency. We feel if we can get you to a point at which you can go to a company and be employed and are 75% capable of doing the work that they want you to do, the employer is more than willing to take on the other 25%. The other thing that we do well, because of the excitement, because of the interest, because of the charisma, because of the romance of what we're doing, we're able to change attitudes. I mean, you know, there are people who come to us with the attitude that, why should I be here 5 days a week? Why can't I be here 4 days a week? Why can't I miss blueprint reading? I know that stuff. Well, I don't need that math. I don't need this milling machine. And we're saying, listen, you're buying the package. It's 35 hours a week. It's 5 days a week. It's 10 months. We want you to buy this package simply because you may have some of the skill sets, but we want to know that when you leave here, you're going to be at work 10 minutes early every day. You're going to be there for the 8 hours or 10 hours. You're going to be there for the next 5 or 6 or 7 years. You understand fully how important you are in that process of manufacturing. So we're about teaching not only the technology, but we're also teaching what is called simply the soft skills. Those are very, very important today. And employers will tell you, Frank, in many cases, we can educate someone about the technology. We do not have the time to educate people about being here on time and communicating and, you know, being part of a team approach.
So, Frank, how do we reach into the inner city, and we particularly see among young adults who are unemployed or underemployed, how do we reach into the inner city and get them to become interested in manufacturing?
Well, I think like anything else, you have to bring it to them. I think that's very, very important. That's why we want to go to Hartford. I think what we're doing with young people, and if we can excite those fourth and fifth and sixth graders, obviously they have parents, they have someone at home, they have an aunt and an uncle, they have other people. And, you know, it's like anything else. We're going to open a program in the late afternoon for individuals. We'll start out with 50, 60, 70, 80 people. We'll grow that to 200 or so over a period of time, simply because, again, success begets success. I mean, there is no question, there is no simple formula, but I think once we get that first group of 10, 20, 30, 40 adults through the program successfully and into careers in advanced manufacturing, our goal really, and you know, and it may sound, you know, somewhat sophomoric, but we believe that as a result of what we're going to be doing in Hartford, that we're going to bring industry to Hartford. You know, we're going to revive that whole Homestead Avenue area, Albany Avenue, in which there's probably a million square feet of industrial space that's actually in pretty good condition, but is dormant. We think that there are pharmaceutical companies. We think that there are manufacturers, whether it's aerospace or not, who want to be where there is a workforce. And, you know, the reality, Dan, is where are kids being born? They're not being born in Simsbury and in Glastonbury. They're being born in Hartford and in New Haven and Bridgeport. So we need to go.
So has this program started in Hartford?
No, we have not started. Okay. No, we are working with the mayor. We're working with the city council. We're working with the superintendent of schools. We have everybody, you know, very, very excited, very interested. We're looking at a number of funding opportunities, but we're committed to a building. We know that we're going to have 20,000 square feet in that building. And we are going to get started within the next year. So, yeah, so, I mean, we've done all the groundwork. We've met with all the CBOs, the community-based organizations. We've met with, you know, just about everyone who has anything to say. Trinity College is involved. University of Hartford's involved. We're going to get St. Joe's involved. So, yeah, it's a major, major effort, a lot of participation, and we've done a lot of work in the past 2 years. So we think we're going to hit the ground running. Capital Community College has made a full commitment to this program, but it has to be, Dan. I mean, if we're gonna have a workforce, we need to look at these young people and what we can do for them and their families is absolutely, you know, so significant.
To think about industry returning to downtown Hartford,
exactly,
would be a phenomenal story.
Absolutely,
Frank.
Absolutely. So I mean, you know, again. It's a situation in which we need to use all of this experience and expertise that we've evolved. I mean, that's our responsibility. We just can't leave it in Enfield. We need to spread it to whether it's as we have it in Bridgeport and as we have in, you know, at Quinebaug and Danielson and Waterbury. We need to bring it to Hartford, to Springfield. I think that's our responsibility as people who work in the public sector.
What a way to end the program. Frank, thank you very much for joining us today on Front and Center.
God bless you. Thank you, Dan, and thank you, audience, for listening.